and shouldn't behave, which raises the question of whether the male pursuer mandate is biologically or socially constructed. Even evolutionary psychology allows that gender roles in mating are flexible, meant to respond to stress and change, to ecological and biological realities. Glenn Gehr, my colleague at the State University of New York at New Paltz, is an evolutionary psychology professor and the co-author of Mating Intelligence Unleashed, The Role of the Mind in Sex, Dating, and Love. He explained that the female urge to pursue is more likely to kick in when the reproductive tables are turned. Her position as chooser weakens as she ages and her fertility declines, the so-called cougar phenomenon. There's probably a tipping point when females stop having an upper hand in mating, he said. Correspondingly, even fertile younger women may be more likely to chase in situations where there aren't many men. Both scenarios, women looking for mates later in their reproductive lives and majority female environments, are increasingly common, particularly for educated women and men. The average age of a first-time mother is rising. Women outnumber men on college campuses nationwide. Taking into account environmental and situational variables, then, romantic pursuit becomes less about what men and women fundamentally are or should be, and more about a way of responding to a real or perceived condition of mate scarcity. It seems no coincidence that for college women, becoming more professionally successful is also connected to diminished mating prospects. Enhancing your own ability to provide is another way of taking charge when the competition for mates and their resources goes up. Yet while we've come to accept female determination in the work world, female perseverance still rankles in matters of love. No matter what the environmental factors are, the proclivity to get hung up on a particular someone is vital to the survival of our species. Romantic obsession and pursuit are adaptations for both men and women in the mating game. We focus exclusively on one person because it fosters pair bonds, which help us raise offspring successfully. It takes a long time to go through a pregnancy and take care of a child, said social psychologist Arthur Aaron. Having both parents helps the child survive. If our ancestors didn't have a strong motivation to bond and connect, we might not be here as a species. So what drives us to jealousy and pursuit is integrally linked to the forces that create us and make us thrive, even though, like many fundamental human motivations, the drive to bond, as Aaron put it, can run awry. Angela, a translator in her mid-40s, met Heinrich at a run-down hostel in Augsburg while she was spending a year teaching in Germany. She was 25, and he was about to turn 30. He had these piercing blue eyes, she said. I remember not being able to look at him because his gaze was so bright. Heinrich made it clear he wanted to see her again. He gave her his address in former East Berlin, an exotic place to her in the wake of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and he encouraged her to visit. A couple of months later, she traveled to the city with a friend. They didn't know anyone there, so they bought a bottle of wine and stopped by Heinrich's apartment unannounced. The three spent the evening drinking together. He invited Angela to return. It was a time in her life when she felt extremely unmoored. Her adolescence and early 20s had been consumed by a relationship with a much older man. Her job in Germany was giving her some badly needed confidence. But she also felt alone. All of a sudden, I was out there in the world trying to figure out things on my own, she said. I hadn't ever learned to be a grown-up by myself. I wasn't used to feeling like an adult without a man to guide me. The next time she was in Berlin, she met Heinrich for drinks. He kissed her. His assertiveness marked him as a good beacon for her, she remembered. He was what she thought she needed to feel more settled. And then she was smitten. Heinrich visited her in Stuttgart, where she was teaching. They fell into bed. She was astonished when he entered her without using a condom. They hadn't talked about whether she was on birth control. Before the next time they made love, she bought condoms and gave them to him. He didn't use them, though, so she started taking birth control pills. Their affair lasted just a few weeks. When she came to see him, he would greet her at the train with two bicycles. East Berlin was all about bicycling, so I was riding around on my perfect Eastern bicycle. It was great, she said. I dreamed what was happening into this fantasy, and he was providing the props for me to live it out. She arrived one weekend on the eve of his 30th birthday. They planned to celebrate the next day with his friends. Soon after she got to his apartment, he excused himself to make a phone call. There was no private telephone service in his neighborhood, so she knew he would have to go to the corner and stand in line. She waited patiently. When he came back, he said, "I have something to tell you. I'm not really in love with you." She focused right away on the phone call. Whom did he call? Did the conversation change his mind, or was it irrelevant? I felt like if I could only figure out what was wrong about that phone call, that would have made it all right again, she said. She went back to Stuttgart in disbelief. She could barely get herself out of bed each morning to drag herself to her office. It was paralyzing, she said. All she could think was that she needed to talk to him. She sent letter after letter asking him to call her. The mail service was fast and reliable throughout Germany, so she knew he was getting all her letters. She imagined that same phone booth and all the people in line who would hear him as he spoke to her, witnessing what was going on between them. Perhaps these German strangers would recognize the injustice of it all, of this bright-eyed man who had romanced her and then very suddenly backed away. He didn't answer her letters, and he didn't call. 2 weeks later, his silence became so oppressive that Angela impulsively rushed to the train station and boarded the train to Berlin, an 8-hour trip. She showed up at Heinrich's door at midnight. She was terrified that he wouldn't be home or that he would be with someone else. He answered the door alone. He set up a pallet on the floor and asked her to go to sleep. I made a point of sobbing so long and so loud that he eventually came in to comfort me by having sex with me, she said. Then he sent me away the next morning. From an evolutionary perspective, Angela's dramatic journey was a demonstration of commitment, of the time and attention she was willing to devote to him. See how much you mean to me? See what I can give you? Rejection goads us to action, despite the possibility of failure and stigma, because being cut out of mating is an evolutionary dead end, Gare said. That's why we see a lot of things in the mating domain that make people uncomfortable, that people see as difficult or strange. At the end of the day, mating is Darwin's bottom line. Intense pursuit and expressions of need can force the beloved to heed his pursuer, shifting his attention and energy away from competing interests, sexual and otherwise. The pursuer's demanding presence may cause the target's other mating prospects to decide they'd rather not go through the trouble of dealing with an insistent rival. For these reasons, pursuit can sometimes succeed in winning back an estranged partner. Adaptations have to work only some of the time to have staying power in a species. Angela's chase worked only as what evolutionary psychologists call a short-term mating strategy, consolation sex with Heinrich. Adding salt to the wound of rejection is the fact that the beloved's ability to turn you down in itself makes him more appealing. It's a sign of high mate value. As Gare explained, it's an ironic and not pleasant fact of human social life that not everyone's in a position to engage in social rejection, but when they do, it's immediately attractive. That person sees himself as having options. The stakes in winning the rejector rise. People who have been refused may want that person even more because they perceive that person as having a higher mate value, he said. But they are also thinking, wow, this is going to help my confidence and assessment as a person and my own mate value if I can get the person to say yes. Inasmuch as the impulse to nurture prospective offspring could make a woman a discriminating chooser, once she's chosen, she may very well chase. J.D. Duntley, a professor of criminal justice and psychology at the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, and David Buss, an evolutionary psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, have published research theorizing that women engage in stalking primarily to prevent a partner from leaving or to get him back if he does leave. Men, they hypothesize, stalk for those reasons as well, but they are more likely than women to engage in pre-relationship stalking as a strategy to win a mate in the first place. Buss's extensive surveys on jealousy revealed that women reacted more strongly to emotional infidelity, in keeping with the evolutionary psychology theory that a partner's involvement with another woman siphons off his resources and attention. Men reacted more strongly to sexual infidelity, which could trick them into providing resources for offspring who aren't their own. Our reproductive success may be the furthest thing from our mind. We use birth control, including methods such as implants and IUDs, which require attention only every few years, until we're ready for children, and then, increasingly, we rely on technologies from hormone shots to IVF to help us conceive. We may choose never to have children. Same-sex romantic pursuit, no less intense than hetero chasing, doesn't have the same direct link to reproduction. The lived connection between sex and childbearing is far looser for us than it was for our ancestors, even if the same genetic impulses course through us. Even Angela, who had unprotected sex and thus real reason to worry about potential offspring, wasn't consciously thinking about losing a possible father to her child. She mourned for the loss of his companionship to her. Without Heinrich, she remembered, the unmoored feeling in her life returned. I had to get him back, she said. It was an existential fear. I thought he was my lifeline. He really wasn't, but it sure did seem like it during that time. We most often hear the psychological term attachment to describe the importance of a secure bond between parent and child for the child's survival and emotional development. But attachment has powerful benefits for adults as well. Romantic love holds out the promise of connection to a person who, in an echo of the parenting role, can provide an interchange of caregiving and attachment. It's what psychologists call a secure base for exploration, promoting feelings of safety and confidence that allow partners to engage in the world in a focused and secure way. Neuroscientists, in fact, are finding that both parent-infant bonds and adult couples work from the same motivational systems in the brain. Men and women react to separation and loss, much as children, and for that matter, other baby mammals do. Their bodies gear up for pursuit. Heart rate and body temperature go up. The abandoned mammal is vigilant, stressed, and unable to sleep, its entire body geared toward reestablishing attachment. It's what psychiatrists Thomas Lewis, Fari Amini, and Richard Lannan identified as the protest response, activated when emotional attachments are ruptured. We can focus on little else. The drive to reestablish contact is sufficiently formidable that people often cannot resist it, even when they understand that the other person doesn't want anything to do with them, the authors write in A General Theory of Love. This basic response doesn't vary significantly by gender. Brain scans of men and women who have been rejected recently look similar, said psychology professor Arthur Aaron, who was part of the team of researchers on Helen Fisher's landmark brain scan studies on people in love and after romantic rejection. What may make a difference in whether the lovelorn follow through on the urge to chase are childhood trauma and attachment style. Neglect, physical abuse, and sexual abuse early in life increase the likelihood of criminal stalking and soft stalking, unwanted pursuit behaviors, UPBs, that characterize obsessive relational intrusion, but are less extreme than criminal stalking. People who have what's called an anxious, also known as preoccupied, ambivalent, or insecure attachment style, are more given to experiencing unrequited love. And, as several studies show, they're more inclined to engage in UPBs after romantic rejection in both opposite-sex and same-sex scenarios. One study revealed a majority, 58%, of pursuers were classified as insecurely attached. The markers of insecure attachment are obsessiveness, insecurity, and moodiness in relationships. People with an insecure attachment style have high expectations of love. When they're in a relationship, the partner's attention is never quite enough. They have trouble making relationships last, or they're given to serial unrequited attractions, always seeking someone they can't have. More anxiously attached people place a lot of importance on relationships and place their identity on these relationships, said Leela B. Dutton, one of the study's authors and a professor of criminal justice at the University of New Haven. Relationships are more significant to them than to someone with a secure attachment style. Her study found that another equally significant predictor of pursuit is how much distress the rejected lover feels over the loss of the relationship. The level of hurt, anger, frustration, resentment, loneliness, and jealousy all contribute to the likelihood of pursuit. Someone who has a generally positive view of herself and others and is usually comfortable with intimate relationships could end up a needy chaser if her emotional investment in the relationship is sufficiently fraught. A recent major personal loss, such as a death or a prior breakup, may be a contributing factor. And if rejection occurs in a situation that's antagonistic to the relationship in the first place, such as a same-sex couple marginalized in a predominantly straight community, unwanted pursuit is more likely to happen. Someone who is otherwise a fine and healthy person may try to get someone back and participate in unwanted pursuit because of the circumstances, even though they would say the behavior is uncharacteristic for them, Dutton said. While the protest response can push the unwanted woman to behave in ways she may regret, it's important to acknowledge the life-preserving impulses the reaction embodies. You're not only protesting rejection, you're also protesting the emotional and physical body blow it can entail. The next emotional stage after the protest response is despair, a physiological state that can include lethargy, loss of appetite, and profound sadness. Rejected lovers react very much like people suffering physical pain or grieving over the death of a loved one. 40% of rejected lovers show signs of depression. Women are more inclined toward anxiety and depression than men, while men are more likely to resort to substance abuse. The finality of a breakup is rougher on young, unmarried women whose mental health tends to decline more than their male counterparts, who, interestingly, have a harder time than women when ongoing relationships get stressful. Researchers speculate that despite all the changes in women's social and economic status, a woman's identity and self-worth may still be overly tied up in having a man. Overall, the loss of love can affect sleep and weaken our immune response. Though the end of a relationship shouldn't be fatal, it can be. It is a leading factor in suicide. We're more vulnerable to social isolation, which increases death rates among heart and cancer patients and heightens the risk of illness or death. That's not to say that winning over an estranged beloved or even having a committed partner is the only way to a healthy existence. But the protest response is linked to our survival instincts and our need to have a caring social support system. Though the unwanted woman's chase might be in vain, it offers her a way to ward off this cascade of misery. Getting on the train to go see him, that was my first happy moment, Angela said. I thought I could get him back. I could get my life back. I felt powerless, and I took action. I have listened to many stories like Angela's of women who took action to protest rejection. I'm struck by the rebellious freedom of getting on that train. There's an emotional honesty in these moments. The unwanted woman is doing something instead of sinking into despair. She is swept up by instinct, by the profound human need for attachment, which the era of romantic practicality has tried to reduce to a game. I know I should be moved, only so far. The journey of the chase, whether it is a day-long train ride across Germany or years of effort to win a beloved, may take us away from our hopelessness. But once we confront a beloved and his refusal to love, we face a new set of questions. How vigorously do we protest? Maggie, a 36-year-old country singer and songwriter, was raised with the message that she could pursue what she wanted in life with just as much determination as a man. Her grandfather was a sanitation worker in Brooklyn, and her father started working at age 9 delivering newspapers. He shined shoes, joined the army, and struggled his way into the middle class, becoming an accountant. As he brought up his own children in relative comfort, he tolerated few excuses from either Maggie or her older brother. "I was raised never to give up," she said. "You were supposed to just keep trying." When her boyfriend of 3 years left her abruptly, she felt she had to do something to get him back. She came up with the most romantic gesture she could think of. She would serenade him with love songs. She rehearsed a set list of Johnny Cash tunes with a fiddle player and another singer to harmonize. Her gesture was a traditionally male one, but she didn't think about it that way. "I believed in the power of music. I wanted to come back with that redeeming quality," she said. "I thought, if I don't try, I'll never know if I could have gotten back with him, and the worst thing that could happen is that I'll feel as awful as I'm feeling now." Her ex left town for 3 weeks, during which her plans for the ensemble fell through. She prepared to serenade him alone. He had always loved her music. She fantasized that the moment he heard her, he would remember that he loved her. She knew that he worked an overnight shift once a week, changing the displays at a gourmet supermarket. He was living with his parents, so serenading him after work was the only way to find him alone. The first week he was back, she drove by the store during his usual shift and saw his car there. She waited in the parking lot until he emerged at sunrise. The moment she walked toward him with her mandolin, she realized her plan wasn't going to work. She began to play anyway. He stopped her. "I can't hear that right now," he said. It's over. He got in his car and drove off. Not giving up staved off her hopelessness and despair for a while, but her persistence also obscured what I call the line. The line is the often blurry boundary between trying hard and trying too hard. It's the divide between courtship and aggression, between striving and violating someone else's life. However well-intentioned Maggie's idea was, she was so absorbed in her plot that she couldn't see that confronting her ex alone in a parking lot before dawn might come across as disturbing rather than romantic. Romantic pursuit may be just as natural a tendency for a woman as for a man, but both have to face the same question. How ardently can you protest rejection without crossing the line? When Sylvia, 34, an editor, met Joseph, she had recently broken off her engagement to another man. The split wasn't traumatic. She had gradually realized that they didn't have as much in common as she once thought. She knew she didn't want to live permanently in France, where he was from. She moved to Chicago, ready to set up her own adult life in the city she loved. She planned to find a steady job, establish deep roots, and find someone she felt more compatible with. From the first time Sylvia spotted him at a cocktail party, Joseph impressed her as exceptionally charismatic. All the eyes in the room gravitate toward him, she said. He wants everyone's attention and thrives on it. Yet, when they were one-on-one, he listened intently. They had a similar sense of humor, both silly and cutting. What was missing with her French fiancé, that sense of common interests, was there right away with Joseph. In the 2 years Sylvia and Joseph were together, though, he was never fully hers. At times, she was certain he was gay. The first several times they tried to have sex, he couldn't keep an erection. He told her that once in college he'd taken ecstasy and fooled around with a man. He dwelled on her physical descriptions of her past male lovers. She watched him let men hit on him, and he would flirt back. Sylvia was also tormented by his furtive pull toward other women. She discovered he'd lied about where he was on a Saturday night so he could go out with a girl he once slept with. He took several trips overseas to visit other women and never invited her. She was sure he had affairs. By the end of their relationship, she said, he never seemed to tell the truth. He would lie about what was in a drawer in his apartment, she said. When they split up, their mutual friends flocked around Joseph, who avoided her and portrayed her as the bitter one. All my friends dumped me except this one girl, she said. She went to dinner with the remaining friend. Sylvia drank too much wine and found she couldn't stop herself from venting her anger. I was trying to explain why this guy was so awful and why I'd felt so betrayed, she said. The more incidents I described to her, the more the bad stuff kept piling up. In the wake of the breakup, she had been calling Joseph a lot, trying to learn the reasons he lied and kept her at an emotional distance. Their conversations often escalated into arguments. He never gave her satisfying answers. At dinner with her friend, she called again to berate him. He hung up on her. She kept calling back. I knew I was going to a bad place, she said. I told my friend, this isn't good. I've got to go home, chill out, watch a movie, and get back to myself. At home, nothing helped. No matter what movie she watched, she saw manipulation. Even Young Guns 2, a 1980s Brat Pack Western that always cheered her up, couldn't distract her. I tried to read a book. No matter what I did, I couldn't stop feeling blindingly angry. I thought I wasn't going to get rid of my anger until I dumped it on the person who deserved it. Around 2 a.m., she took a cab to Joseph's apartment and knocked on his door to wake him up. She demanded he listen to her. She collapsed into a chair, half sitting on a notepad he'd left there. She looked at what he'd written. There was this big, long, emotional letter to this girl he'd known earlier in his life, she said. He hadn't been in touch with her for 5 years, but then he was writing about how he wanted to visit her in California. It was only 3 weeks after we'd broken up. It put me over the edge. He had no pity, no regret, no shame for all of this horrible stuff that he had done to me. She yelled at him to tell her the truth about himself. She slapped him in the face. "Don't do that," he said. He threatened to call the police. "Go ahead," she retorted. When the police arrived, she was crying so hard that she couldn't answer their questions. Joseph told them he didn't want them to arrest her. He just wanted her to leave. An officer guided her by the shoulders into the squad car to take her home. The radio was set to a light FM station playing a love song. "How could you play a song like that?" she protested. "Can't you see how terrible this is?" The police officer told her he wanted to cover up the sound of her weeping and she should calm down. "You don't understand," she protested. "He cheated on me, and I'm the one who gets arrested."
"At least you got a pop in before you had to leave," he chided her.
That night wasn't the last time Sylvia felt intense anger at Joseph, but it was the last time she confronted him about it. "I would think back to that night and say, 'That's not you. Try to let the past be past.'" Her determination to get some kind of justice for herself didn't get her anywhere. She was never going to learn the truth about Joseph's life. He was never going to acknowledge the pain he'd caused her. When Sylvia thinks back to the confrontation with Joseph, she is struck by the rage she felt at her powerlessness. His withdrawal sent her back to some all-too-familiar childhood feelings. "I grew up with difficult parents, and I often felt my emotional needs weren't met by them," she said. When Joseph first came into her life, he gave her more support than she'd ever known. "He put on this show of, 'I want to make you the happiest woman in the world,'" she said. "It was the first time someone worked so hard to make me think he would meet my needs, and then he turned into a shapeshifter. He shut off like a steel trap." She remembers vividly a moment in the heat of their argument when she saw herself reflected back through his eyes. "I was that crazy psycho bitch that every man imagines lives inside of every woman," she said. The crazy psycho bitch haunts many of us as we contend with rejection. The primal frustration we feel gives us little real power to get love back or to get a satisfying explanation of what went wrong. Yet the psycho bitch continues to protest, refusing to let her beloved get away with ambivalence, bad behavior, and the emotional blow of abandonment. She has the determination of a heroine, but she goes too far. Her disturbing persistence is a distortion of the Protestant work ethic, equal opportunity ideal. If you try hard enough, you can get what you really want. The psycho bitch embodies both the fierceness and the shame of being a woman who can't accept rejection and move on. There are reasons why the psycho bitch surges forth. Sylvia had lost the man she thought would provide the love and care she always yearned for and didn't get as a child. Her protest response was sharpened by frustration at how withholding Joseph could be, along with the evolutionary challenge of jealousy. His attention and resources went elsewhere. Neurobiologically, when people realize that a reward, love, sex, drugs, isn't going to happen, the brain's network for rage, which is closely connected to areas in the prefrontal cortex that assess and expect rewards, is triggered. Unfulfilled expectations can make us furious and aggressive. Animals denied and expected pleasure will bite or attack. Mark Eatonson, a Sacramento-based psychologist, says that overwhelming stress and anger can cause otherwise stable people to temporarily lose control. Ideally, we develop a broad range of ways of dealing with adversity, and we can move fluidly between them and choose the right tool for the right situation, he said. When life throws us a series of curveballs, those defenses can be overwhelmed. You can fall back into a more primal way of dealing with the world. Sylvia's story brings up what's troubling about explaining romantic pursuit. Chasing may be an unconscious urge inherent to the perpetuation of the species, but we also have to acknowledge what happens when pursuit goes awry and becomes intrusive. The urge to protest rejection and run after love may be just as innate to women as it is to men. But that means that women have to contend with the implications of chasing too hard. Sylvia was standing, as I had stood, right on the line, where objection blurs confusingly with violation. 5. Falling from the stars, losing yourself to the narcissism of unrequited love. The lowest point of my obsession began when B put aside the baseball bat and let me into his apartment. I told him I was too distraught to leave his side. He relented. We took a long walk on the wooded trail of Frick Park. It was right before Thanksgiving, and the park was nearly deserted. From time to time, I would stop him and put my arms around him, trying to break through his reserve, but it was like embracing a statue. He wouldn't hold me, and he wouldn't look into my eyes. In the late afternoon, we ended up in my apartment. He let me touch him, and he touched me back. At first, what we were doing felt optimistic, as if it could bring us to something healthy and right, freeing him from his confusion and me from my obsession. But then a sense of despair came between us. Was he with me only because I had begged him to be? He didn't want to enter me. Half undressed, we gave each other orgasms. The intimacy was not a victory. It was an empty room, a mountaintop with no view, a holy grail made out of tinfoil. It was barren and sad. He told me he had to return to his apartment and pack. He was catching a train the next morning to Washington, D.C., where he would spend Thanksgiving with his girlfriend and her family. Stunned, I watched him go. The next morning, I went downtown alone to rent a white Kia. Several times during the 8-hour drive to my family Thanksgiving in Connecticut, I pulled off the highway to call B from payphones. I left long messages explaining why we should be together. I begged him to call me, to see me, to let the relationship that was supposed to happen between us finally begin. End it with her, I urged his voicemail. I could barely speak to my family over the holiday. I buried myself in the work I'd gotten behind on, sneaking away from time to time to leave more messages. I couldn't stop myself. I didn't know what direction my life would go if he were not in it. I kept calling, even though the words I spoke began to sound ugly, not because I threatened him, I never did, but because I was so needy. My future seemed incomprehensible. My pride was gone. Every message embarrassed me. I wanted to take back the words as they emerged. I think I said as much, awkwardly, on one of the messages. If he loved me back, I knew I would be different, my power and my allure restored. But that wasn't happening. I seemed to have sacrificed my entire being to an impossible love. Many of the women I've surveyed and interviewed about unrequited love testify to this dark shift when they became someone they couldn't recognize. They neglected their work, they isolated themselves, they ate too much or too little. They smoked, drank, took drugs, cut themselves, and engaged in other risk-taking behaviors. More than half of the women in my online survey said they felt like they were losing their mind. It ate up years of my life and energy, wrote a 35-year-old public health administrator from New Mexico. My life had become sad and small due to my obsession. A 43-year-old student recounted, I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I almost failed my courses, I broke my husband's heart. Talia Witkowski, a Los Angeles-based psychologist, described herself in her teens and 20s as a kind of serial unrequited lover. She once traveled to Shanghai to be with a man she'd had a fling with, even though he warned her that he was seeing someone else and didn't want her to visit. She spent the trip in a depressed funk and drank heavily. Her obsessions felt like slavery, like I'd been overcome by a kind of monster, she said. Nothing mattered but having the person return my love. I became extremely manipulative, compromised my integrity and morals just to get him to have sex with me. There was no pleasure in it. Unrequited love, as we've seen, often revolves around what we imagine the beloved to be and how loving him makes us see the world in new ways. The revelatory potential of unrequited love lies in our ability to step back and recognize what is motivating our yearning. When the unwanted woman loses herself to unrequited love, she can't separate herself from her fantasies about the beloved and their future together. In this state, the love means everything to her and seems to merit every effort, no matter how hurtful or self-destructive. This can seem like martyrdom. She feels she's doing it all for him. But this state of abjection is a profoundly narcissistic one. It's all about her and her investment in the fantasy of love that she has created. Nothing illustrates this state more vividly than the saga of astronaut Lisa Nowak. Nowak had a 3-year extramarital affair with William Oefelein, an astronaut colleague. The romance ended when he informed her in a crowded NASA gym that he'd fallen in love with another woman. 3 weeks later, Nowak drove 900 miles from Houston to Orlando, wearing an adult diaper so she wouldn't have to stop to urinate. Then she donned a dark wig and a trench coat and followed Oefelein's new girlfriend, Air Force Captain Colleen Shipman, through a parking garage. When Shipman refused to talk to her, Nowak attacked her with pepper spray. And so Nowak became the astronaut, driven crazy by lust in space, inspiring one-liners such as this one by Jay Leno. She went to court yesterday and was released on her own incontinence. The media merrymaking reflected an all-too-common reaction to female stalking. Laughing is a way to shake off how frightening it is, a way to feel in control when faced with the prospect of a woman gone haywire. Nowak's stalking was scary, and it could have been worse. Just before she was arrested, she was seen stuffing in the trash a bag containing a loaded BB gun. She was carrying a 4-inch buck knife and a steel mallet. The attack traumatized Shipman, who pleaded for a restraining order and testified in court about living in a constant state of fear. Shipman and Oefelein are now married and running a freelance writing and photography business in Alaska. The incident also put NASA under intense scrutiny. How could a woman so emotionally unstable not only have been sent into space the year before, but also be slated to be the voice of mission control for the next scheduled shuttle flight? The fact is that before the breakup with Oefelein, Nowak showed little indication of being out of control. She had spent most of her career proving herself worthy of being chosen for a space mission, juggling long days and rigorous training regimens with raising 3 children. Earlier in her career, she applied 6 times to get into the Navy's test pilot school. One reason she kept being denied was that her legs didn't meet the minimum length requirement. She challenged the policy, which disproportionately affected women, and finally got in. After she was chosen to become an astronaut, she had to respond to reporters who queried her about daring to aspire to space travel when she had kids at home. "Anything you do is risky," she calmly told them. In 2003, not long after she found out she was scheduled for an upcoming space mission, the Columbia exploded, killing her best friend, Laurel Clark, and the rest of the crew. Nowak buried her own sense of loss and her rising fears about meeting the same fate by throwing her energy into helping Clark's family through their grief. The mission she was scheduled for was canceled as NASA tried to figure out what went wrong. During this acutely stressful time, Nowak's affair with Opheline began. When Nowak did go on the 2006 Discovery mission, her role required the utmost in focus. She was one of two robo-chicks assigned to operate the controls of the robotic arm that would allow the crew to examine the underside of the spacecraft for damage. One moment of inattention and the arm could swing wildly in the weightlessness of space, endangering the shuttle and its crew. She did her job well, and the Discovery's successful mission provided the world with more proof that NASA had bounced back from the Columbia disaster. After the Discovery landed, Nowak toured elementary schools, made a triumphant appearance at her alma mater, the U.S. Naval Academy, and sat for an interview with Ladies' Home Journal. She was slated to be on the cover of the May 2007 issue celebrating motherhood. After Nowak's February arrest, several of her NASA colleagues felt, along with the shock of what she'd done, the loss of a valued colleague. Laurel Clark's widower, Dr. John Clark, a former NASA flight surgeon, became one of several NASA colleagues who expressed support for Nowak. He described her as having been wonderful and nurturing in his family's time of grief. In a letter to the Florida judge deciding Nowak's case, Clark said that astronauts could be vulnerable to depression from a letdown period after the tremendous high of flying in space. Nowak's downfall was a collective loss. The Ladies' Home Journal cover was canned before the issue went to press. That uber-working mom at the pinnacle of human achievement was gone. And she had been ours, a product of our space program, our tax dollars, our progress on getting women into the most demanding and competitive professions, and our ongoing, impractical desire to watch our fellow human beings go beyond the Earth's gravitational pull. The scandalous titillation of Nowak's ruin obscured the importance of these losses and how very sad her downfall was. The morning of her arrest, Nowak sat in the Orlando Police Department, utterly bewildered. She repeatedly insisted that what she had done wasn't normal for her. She was a good woman, a woman of accomplishment. "How could this be happening to me?" she asked. As exceptional as Nowak's life was, her bafflement is something any woman who has ever lost herself to unrequited love can relate to. When Nowak was 6, she watched Neil Armstrong step on the moon and knew she wanted to become an astronaut. So many children have this dream. They look at the glittering dome of the night sky and want to be there. She was one of the rare ones who made it. And then she fell, hard and fast, from the stars. Why does obsessive love have this power? Its neurochemistry gives us some basic insight. The addictive, reward-seeking mechanism of passionate love becomes more extreme. The unrequited lover is like a junkie, willing to do anything for a fix. She is flooded with feeling, fear, anger, guilt, shame, jealousy, and sadness. She has a goal she can't achieve. It hurts her, frustrates her, pisses her off. Nowak also saw a clear obstacle to her love, another woman. Dr. Lou Ann Brizendine, the director of the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic at the University of California, San Francisco, has commented that while it's normal to have rageful, jealous fantasies of hurting your rival, Nowak took the additional step of acting on them. Brizendine saw in Nowak's behavior signs that she was in a fixed delusional state, in which a clearly false belief, in this case, something along the lines of, if I attack my rival, I will get my lover back, seems indisputably true. Nowak was functioning normally in every other area of her life, yet lost her grip on reality and self-control when it came to coping with Opheline's rejection. Other psychologists have speculated that Nowak had a personality disorder, which means that even though she functioned normally in everyday life, jealousy may have exposed disturbed patterns of thinking, feeling, and behavior underneath her hyperachiever surface. I would do anything for you. In Mutual Love, this line shimmers. With its connotation of self-sacrifice, the phrase seems a romantically extreme expression of commitment. But in Unrequited Love, the object, the you, doesn't want the commitment. So the expression becomes suspect, raising the question, what exactly is it that you're sacrificing yourself for? The answer may lie in the complex dynamics of narcissism. The martyred, unrequited lover sacrifices herself to herself, the self she believes will emerge from her beloved's attention, the noble creature trapped inside the suffering beast. The normal sort of narcissism that can emerge in passionate new love becomes entrenched and highly emotionally charged, said forensic psychologist J. Reed Malloy. You feel like you have a right to pursue this person, and you see yourself as different from other people. The greater your self-absorption, the less empathy you feel for others. This can be the beginning of a dangerous path, as Nowak's story shows, a pathology of narcissism in which the obsessed lover becomes acutely sensitive to rejection and feels shamed and humiliated by it, triggering the urge to retaliate. Amber, a 38-year-old aspiring actress in New Jersey, was in the Hudson County Correctional Facility on a drug conviction when she met Roy. The other women in her cell would get up on the sink and talk to men through an air vent. They urged Amber to try it herself. The man on the other side had a deep, raspy voice and spoke slowly. I loved his voice, she said. It sent chills through my spine. They talked through the night. They discovered they were from the same neighborhood in Jersey City and knew a lot of the same people. 3 days later, she saw a guy outside in the courtyard doing triangle push-ups. He had dark skin, short hair, and a slim, muscular body. She found out it was Roy. After she got out of jail, she visited him regularly and sent him money, doing everything a woman was supposed to do. The day he was released, nearly a year after their first conversation through the vent, she waited eagerly for him to arrive. She sat on her porch late into the night, but he didn't show up. He rang the doorbell at 8 the next morning. They slept together, an experience she described as having sex, not making love, as if all the affection he'd expressed while he was behind bars had never existed. He left soon after to go back to his ex-girlfriend, the mother of his daughter. He was blowing me off, she said. I couldn't believe how he made me feel after all the time I'd put into this. She had been sober for over a year, but went out drinking that night. In the 10 years since, Roy has bounced in and out of jail, on and off heroin, and in and out of the relationship with his daughter's mother. None of this has stopped Amber from loving him. Her obsession with him has turned her life into an emotional version of the Groundhog Day movie. Every day she hopes he will change and be fully hers. When Roy is incarcerated, Amber is his only regular visitor. She writes him long letters every night, sends him money, and pays for his cell phone. Behind bars, Roy is expressive and warm. He promises to treat her right. But when he is released, instead of running into her arms, he starts using drugs again and pushes her away. She hangs on. Eventually, he's back in prison, and the cycle of hope and disappointment begins again. Amber knows she's living for the fantasy of a loving life with Roy, but she can't let it go. Her experiences in the here and now are not truly real or important because Roy isn't with her. Her life is on hold. 3 years ago, Amber started living with another man. But whenever Roy is sprung and wants to be with her, she'll kick the man out or insist that Roy sleep on their couch. She loves her live-in boyfriend, but I'm not in love with him. I told him to leave a billion times. I know my heart's not there for him. I told him to get someone who's there 100%. What I want at the end of the day is Roy, the one I'm in love with. We are supposed to be together. Unrequited love can keep the unwanted woman in a frozen state, said Suzanne Lockman, a New York-based clinical psychologist. How can she evolve or grow when her validation comes from a beloved who gives her so little? Her hunger for attention is often rooted in her past. An unavailable father, for example, can lead a woman to fall for an unavailable guy later. It's a phenomenon that psychoanalysis calls transference, the redirection of feelings from a prior relationship, usually in childhood, onto a new person. The reason you are doing it is out of a desperate hope for that person to repair that rupture within you, Lockman said. At the same time, women who have sunk deeply in an unrequited obsession don't feel deserving of reciprocity. They are so used to fighting for love that they blow up the meaning of even the slightest acknowledgement. In their lives, they didn't learn to want more, and they haven't had more. However unsatisfying this frozen state is, it may seem more appealing than the alternative, facing what life is like without the dream of the man who's supposed to be yours. The person can feel better when focused on the fantasy, rather than stepping back and seeing the reality of a blighted life that's sad, lonesome, and full of loss, J. Reed Malloy said. The hard work of mourning is avoided through obsessive thinking. When obsessions become painful and entrenched, and the unwanted woman can't control the pull to be with her rejecting beloved, she enters what psychotherapist Rhonda Findling calls the masochistic zone. Love becomes suffering. You will do anything to keep the connection, she said. You will sell your soul out. Your pride. Life in the masochistic zone doesn't seem anything like narcissism. The popular understanding of the term is that it entails vanity and selfishness. Narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, is characterized by grandiosity, an overwhelming need for admiration, and a lack of empathy for others. Psychologist Mark Eatonson says this diagnosis captures only half of the picture of narcissism. There's also the flip side, which can include vulnerability, shame, fear of dependency, and a proclivity for feeling used, discarded, unimportant, and misunderstood. These are just as essential to narcissism as other traits. What both kinds of narcissism have in common is the tendency to use other people to fulfill parts of the self. When people with narcissism feel like something is missing inside, they will look for it in another person, someone they idealize, he said. And in the narcissist's mind,
That person is experienced as an extension of the self. When that person disappoints the narcissist or fails to meet his or her expectations, the narcissist may savagely devalue the person they formerly idealized. In turn,